Approximately a year ago, here at the Sephardic Institute, I presented a lecture on the history of the biblical canon. And I focused largely on the problem of Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, why we have these three divisions, how they differ from each other, why some specific biblical books are in the one division and not the other. So I'm not going to repeat that, since I'm sure everyone here who was there remembers every word that was said. And since I don't, I certainly am not going to repeat it. Tonight I will attempt to focus primarily on which books were included in Tanakh and why. I'd like to begin, for those who've never heard about the biblical canon, by listing some of the questions that modern scholars raise when they discuss the issues of the biblical canon. I'll also present some of the conclusions of modern scholarship, modern Bible scholarship, which we will then examine in some detail. I will be offering basically a critique of modern scholarship on the biblical canon. As I say, the focus will be on which books were included and which books were excluded from the biblical canon. We know a great deal about Tanakh today, in 1997, much more perhaps than even 100 or 200 years ago. That's in part because we've inherited many mefarshim on Tanakh. Those mefarshim were available in the medieval period. Many were lost. They remained only in manuscript form, only to reappear in the late 19th and in this century. Many mefarshim, the Meiri on many volumes of on some volumes of Tanakh, and many other mefarshim, including the first passage that you have in front of you, were basically not available to us until the 20th century. So we owe a great debt. We owe a great debt to the various mefarshim and the light they've shed on the history of the biblical canon, not to mention, of course, the light they've shed on the plain sense of the biblical text, on Pshuto Shel Mikra. If we know a lot more today about the plain sense of the biblical text, we don't know much more today than we did, say, 200 years ago with regard to the literary history of Tanakh. We do not know when the biblical books were first published. A simple question that every Jew has to ask themselves is, when was Sefer Yeshayahu published for the first time? When was Sefer Yirmiyahu published for the first time? In the lifetime of the prophet, after the death of the prophet, and even if we could answer when it was published, a separate and distinct question would be, and when was it included in Tanakh? So these are very difficult questions. We have very little information that sheds light on these issues. The process by which a book leaves the realm of the ordinary and instead becomes authoritative for religious practice and doctrine, that process is what we call canonization. And that's what we mean by the canonization of the Hebrew Bible, the process by which books left the realm of the ordinary and were recognized as distinct in a variety of ways. Modern scholars who investigate the biblical canon ask the following questions. One, what were the criteria for the inclusion of a book in Tanakh? Two, when were the various biblical books canonized? When were they declared to be part of Tanakh? Three, why were these particular biblical books canonized? Four, when was it decided that no more books can be included in Tanakh? In other words, when was the biblical canon closed? Five, why was the biblical canon closed? Six, who was responsible for making the decisions as to which books would be included in Tanakh? And seven, who was responsible for making that final decision that no more books could be included in Tanakh? Those are seven basic questions. There are many more related questions. Were the criteria for the inclusion of a biblical book always the same? Did they change over the generations? If they changed over the generations, that raises the possibility that the biblical canon that we have today is not necessarily the biblical canon that once was. And just to give you one sample, the very famous Rav, the head of the Hildesheim Rabbinical Seminary at the turn of the century, the author of Shaul Sanchuvus Malamed Lahoyer, Rav David Hoffman, suggests in his commentary on Mishnayos that the book of Ben Sira was once part of Tanakh, but was removed from Tanakh by a later group of Chazal, as distinct from an earlier group that included it in part of Tanakh. Why are the books of the Apocrypha not included in Tanakh? And that's really going to be the focus of this evening's discussion. We'll come back to more details about that a little later. As I say, we have very little evidence. We certainly don't have internal evidence. There's very little evidence in Tanakh itself, even less evidence in Chazal, regarding the history of the canonization of Tanakh. Chazal were not primarily historians. They weren't interested in preserving for us a literary history of the biblical canon. So we're going to have to look for little hints in midrashic passages, in halachic passages. We're going to have to look for little hints in Philo, Josephus, church fathers even, hints in the biblical versions like the Septuagint and so on. And on the basis of those hints, we and indeed modern scholars have done the best they could in terms of writing a history of the biblical canon. Modern Bible scholarship, that is, if you were to go to Harvard or Yale or Princeton and study Bible in a secular setting, as distinct from a yeshiva gedola, modern Bible scholarship has reached certain conclusions with regard to the biblical canon. And very succinctly, I'll try to present those conclusions. If you would buy yourself a biblical handbook, or just go to a library and take out the introductions to the Bible that are being published today, you would discover, and this will surprise some of you, but tonight we're not going to discuss the history of Bible criticism per se. I just want you to know the results of modern scholarship. And the results of modern scholarship are, one, the first biblical book to be canonized is Sefer Devarim in the year 621 BCE. That, two, in the 5th and 4th centuries BCE, under the leadership of Ezra and Nehemiah, the rest of the Chamisha Chumshei Torah were canonized. These are the first biblical books to be canonized. Three, the prophetic books, what we call the Nevi'im, starting from the book of Joshua through the book Treyasar, these books were canonized in the 4th, 3rd centuries BCE, shortly before the Samaritan Schism. There's a group that's still alive, though not very well today, the Shomronim, the Samaritans, in Nablus and Shechem and elsewhere in Israel. The Samaritans, of course, have what kind of biblical canon? What Bible? What do they recognize? Only Torah. Only Torah. The Samaritans have Torah, and they have a little book, Joshua, but that's not the same as our Sefer Yoshua. It's not the biblical Joshua. So all they really have is the Torah. We have more or less a sense of when the Samaritans split from the rest of the Jewish people. Since they only have the Torah, modern scholarship argues that when they split from the Jewish people, the Bible consisted only of the Torah. Had there been Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Melachim as part of the Bible, they would have it in their Bible too. They're ultra-conservative. New York Times would say ultra-orthodox. So if they only have the Torah, that's a sign that in 333 B.C., which is the general date that's given for when they split from the rest of Jewry, if they only have the Torah, then that's a sign that Nevi'im were not yet canonized. But they were surely canonized by 200 BCE, because Sefer Ben Sira, and Ben Sira lived around the year 200 BCE, Sefer Ben Sira cites all the biblical books, starting from the Torah, and then in order, Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Melachim, etc., through Sefer Treyasa. So clearly, the entire Nevi'im was canonized by the year 200 B.C. I'm simply presenting to you the results of modern scholarship. And finally, four, with regard to the writings, the Ketuvim, modern scholarship claims that they were canonized by the Talmudic rabbis in a series of stages, and the process was not really concluded until the 3rd century of the Common Era. The 3rd century of the Common Era, if you like, the beginning of the Amoraic period. And modern scholarship claims that Megillat Esther was the last biblical book to be included in the biblical canon. And there was much debate about it, but it was finally agreed upon that all agreed that it should be part of Tanakh in the 3rd century CE. And the evidence for that, it is claimed, is Talmudic. And so much then for the modern scholarly consensus. That's what you will find in any handbook written today regarding the history of the biblical canon. Now, regarding the earliest stages of the biblical canon, much insight is provided by a Rishon, and that's passage 1. So I want you to take a look now at passage 1 on the pages that you have in front of you. This passage comes from Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi. Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi is one of the great Parshanei HaMikra, a great Jewish scholar who lived in Eretz Yisrael and in Egypt in the 13th century. He was born about 1220, died about 1291. He was a confirmed Maimonidean, a great Jewish thinker, and he's left us beautiful Perushim on Tanakh. Some of these are available at your local farm store here in Brooklyn, and every one is well worth owning. In any event, in his commentary on Yonah, we have this very interesting passage, and I'll read it together with you. Kidvar Hashem Elokei Yisrael Asher Diber Biyad Avdo Yonah Ben Amitai HaNavi. This is a pasuk in Sefer Melachim. This is 2 Kings 14:25. So in 2 Kings 14:25, there's a reference to a nevuah of Yonah. This nevuah of Yonah is not included, of course, in Sefer Yonah. And Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi continues as follows: Zemore ki Yonah hayalo nevuot al Yisrael v'ivtiach v'iyem kishar ha-nevi'im. Yonah had many more prophecies aside from what's included in Sefer Yonah. V'lo matzanu mimenu b'nevuato b'trei asar rak sipur Ninveh b'vad. It's just those few chapters about the story of his mission to Ninveh. That's what's included in Sefer Yonah. But he said much more than that, as you might well imagine. Yonah lived a full life. He surely, that life was not compressed into the four prakim of Sefer Yonah. From this verse in Melachim, which refers to another nevuah of Yonah, he must have had another book, the Avad Meitanu, Kmosha Avad Sefer Hayashar, V'Sefer Divrei Hayamim L'Machay Yehuda, Nevuot Gad V'Hachoze, V'Natan Hanavi, V'Harbei Misifrei Shlomo, V'Chochmato Mishalav. And Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi is simply rehearsing here and reciting a whole series of references that we have in Tanakh to literature that we no longer have. V'ulai ze shenimtza etzleinu miidiyot al ha-malachim v'ha-nevi'im einenu ela chelek min ha-chalakim she'avdu ba'orech ha-galiyot v'emsheich ha-shmadot. And he's suggesting the possibility, very interesting possibility, that we once had many more biblical books, if you like. And what we have today in the biblical canon are the remnants of a much larger literature. V'ze ma shenishar im ha-Torah, what we have today is what remains together with the Torah. Hanimtzeit gamkein asher kodma haftachato yitale shehi lo tishakach mibeinenu. We have a promise from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that the Torah will never be lost. Lo'olam brachamav aleinu v'kiyum brito lavotenu leman lo novad be'ovdena kemo she'amar lo tishakach mipizaro. The end of Sefer Dvarim, it says that the Torah will never be forgotten from the Jewish people. V'lulei kiyuma beinenu im ksat hagadot hamelachim shelanu usridei nevi'enu, and if not for our Tanakh, v'shinui mahalach datenu v'shinui matzavam lefiah, and if not for the distinctiveness of the Jewish people, if not for Tanakh, which separates us from the rest of the universe, ki az hitaravnu im shara amim, if not for that, we would have been lost. We would have assimilated to the to the other nations, v'nishkach shemenu v'yavdam etziyutenu k'mo shekara l'shar ha'amim. Then we would be just like the Assyrians, Babylonians, Phoenicians, people of Ugarit and so on. We would no longer exist like everybody else. It's the books of Tanakh that became our biblical canon that kept us a people alive and a people distinct from all other nations. And he goes on to cite some more psukim to bring home the point. And as a master exegete, and I'm not going to look at it now, but look at it on the end of the passage, he proves to you what the word amar means in biblical Hebrew. Amar in biblical Hebrew doesn't only mean to say, but it has a much wider range of meaning, and in light of that wider range, it sheds light on this whole paragraph and the discussion at hand. In any event, this is a very interesting passage, and particularly interesting because I'm just going to mention now the most recent book on the biblical canon. Anybody who leaves here tonight and wants to learn more about modern scholarship in the biblical canon, there's a scholar at the Hebrew University who's devoted his whole life to the study of the biblical canon. His name is Menachem Haran. He's publishing a trilogy, a three-volume series called Asufa HaMikra'it, the biblical collection, the biblical canon, Asufa HaMikra'it. And volume one has just appeared. It's a massive volume. And when the three volumes appear, this will be the latest word in modern scholarship on the biblical canon. I'm not going to say much more about this other than it's certainly worth reading. His major thesis in the first volume, which I've read from cover to cover, is that the biblical canon as we have it is the remnant of a much larger library that once existed. Exactly what Rav Tanchum Yerushalmi says in this passage, this is what this whole book is all about, though he never mentions Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi. So had he known about Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi, he would have saved a lot of money and paper and ink, could have just quoted Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi. Literally, the whole thesis of this book is summed up in the one paragraph of Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi that you have in front of you. Yes?
I was just questioning the word Me'idiyot Alam Lachim versus canon.
Does that mean? Tell me where you are. Yes, go ahead. I don't see how you see that from the word idiot. What we have now, midiot al hamalachim, meaning our sefer Shmuel, Melachim, the various Nevi'im, Yishayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, einenu ela chelek min hachalakim she'avdu. What we have now is only a remnant of a much larger library that's been lost. Now, what do you want to say beyond that? Idiot, right?
Would apply like this now. Today we have things that are outside what we call Tanakh that we may shed light on the books of Tanakh, but is he necessarily implying by using that word that they're necessarily Tanakh?
My sense is in this whole passage, he only knows about Tanakh, and he doesn't know any other extra biblical evidence that sheds light on the period of the kings of Israel. There would be nothing he would have had available to him in the 13th century. So he cannot...
What I'm saying is go ahead. The book that he's claiming existed.
Right.
Okay. Does he necessarily, by calling them Yedda, does he necessarily claim that they're canonized? That's what I'm asking.
No, that's an open question. It's hard to know. I can't tell from this passage. Okay. That is, this larger library, parts of it may have been part of Tanakh, parts of it may not have been part of Tanakh. There's no possible way... I would not be medayik for one word in this paragraph what he intended. Okay. By the way, since you raise it, I want to stress there's a very famous passage in the Talmud, in Bavli, Mesechet Megillah, Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, where the Gemara says, Nevuah shehu tzricha ledorot nichteva. The Gemara says there were many, many Nevi'im. Kiflayim, Kiyotze, Mitzrayim, there were many Nevi'im that once existed, and there were many Nevuot, and there was much prophecy, but Nevuah shehu tzricha ledorot nichteva. And the question is, Reb Tanchum Yerushalmi knew that too. That is what the Talmud says, is those Nevuot that were necessary for all generations were recorded. But you have to be very careful. What does that Gemara mean? It's not a simple matter what that Gemara means. And I suspect Rav Tanchum understood that Gemara quite correctly. Namely, it doesn't mean that what we now have in our biblical canon is what was written and nothing else was written. What it means is many nevuot were one-time occasions. And Navi delivered a message. It was an oral message. It was never recorded in writing. And there was no reason for it to be recorded in writing because it was for that moment only. But those prophecies that served a larger purpose, they weren't just for that one occasion, but we could learn, all later generations could learn from that nevuah, those nevuot were recorded. But the Gemara doesn't say that everything that was recorded is what we now have today or was preserved. It may well be that Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi agrees fully with that Gemara and Megillah, but what he understands the Gemara to be saying is, yes, whatever was necessary for many generations was recorded, but not everything that was recorded was preserved. And what we now have in our Tanakh is that portion of what was recorded that's also preserved. Far more difficult to explain and understand are the so-called later stages of canonization. That is, even if we accept the theory that's presented here of Rabbi Tanchum Yerushalmi, that simply remnants of the earlier literature have been preserved, and that's basically what makes up Tanakh. These are the remnants, so we have the remnants. This is exactly what Professor Haran says in his book as well, as I just indicated. But in terms of the later periods, we know that what we have today are not just remnants, because in terms of the later periods, we have many more books. We have copies of other books that have pretensions to being biblical books. So, for example, I brought with me the Oxford Annotated Apocrypha. I'm holding one version of the Apocrypha, what technically it nowadays is called in Hebrew the Sfarim HaChitzonim. The Apocrypha is a collection of very interesting books. I'm sure most of you in this room are familiar with many of these books, if not all of them. The Book of Maccabees, First Maccabees, Second Maccabees, the Book of Tobit, the Book of Ben-Sira, the Book of Susanna, the Book of Judith, and many others. These books are part of Roman Catholic Bibles. That are all the books of the Apocrypha. These are ancient books that have come down to us. And I am holding an English translation of the books of the Apocrypha. These are today part of the Roman Catholic Bible. They are rejected by Protestants and kept separate and published as a book called the Apocrypha. Protestants don't consider it part of the Bible, but they say that these books are edifying and should be read, which means, in effect, that a Protestant minister will not cite verses from the Apocrypha in a sermon, but privately he'll read these books and advise you to read them as well. And we Jews don't include them in our Tanakh. They've been rejected from our Tanakh, but now at least we have to ask a serious question. Once we have these books, and they're lovely books, very important books, some of these books are cited in rabbinic literature, the question is obvious. On what grounds was it decided that Kohelet, that Esther, that Eicha, and so on, these are biblical books and included in the biblical canon, and the book of Ben-Sira is not part of the biblical canon? Ben-Sira is wisdom literature. It doesn't differ very much from the kind of information we find in Sefer Mishlei, Kohelet, or even Pirkei Avot. Kohelet and Mishlei are part of Tanakh, and Ben-Sira is not part of Tanakh. It's included in the Apocrypha. So here one can't argue anymore that, well, the rabbis or the Anshei Knesset HaGdola only included the remnants of the literature. They obviously didn't include all the remnants of the literature. There are a lot of other remnants that exist. We actually have copies of these books today. Some of them were discovered in originals in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have original copies of Ben-Sira in Hebrew. Yet the rabbis still rejected those books. Those books are not part of Tanakh. And here we have to ask why. I'm going to take the book of Susanna as a sample. The reason I'm taking the book of Susanna, which is included in the Apocrypha, is that it's only one chapter. So all of us will be able to go home tonight at a reasonable hour if we only discuss the book of Susanna, Shoshana. I beg the indulgence of those who know this book by heart, and for those who are not familiar with it, I'll briefly summarize the key portions of it. It's a beautiful book. It inspired much art and music in the medieval and Renaissance period. Anyone who's a master of Baroque art and music will be familiar with Susanna. In any event, begins by saying that there was a man living in Babylon whose name was Jehoiakim, and his wife's name was Susanna, the daughter of Hilkiah. She was a very beautiful woman, and she feared the Lord. Her parents were righteous, strict observers of the laws of Moses. And two elders, two shoftim, after being appointed as judges, fell in love with Susanna, lusted after her, and at one point plotted against her. And they noticed that on certain days of the week, she could be seen leaving her home and going to what we would today call pretty much a mikveh. And once they noticed her going to this bathhouse, she would close the doors, the maids would leave her, leave her in her privacy, and then the maids would come back and take her back to her home. The two plotted against her, ran in once when she was in the bathhouse, and basically said, "Look, the garden doors are shut, no one sees us, we are in love with you, so give your consent and lie with us. If you refuse, we will testify against you that a young man was with you, and this is why you sent your maids away." Shoshana, Susanna was married, a married woman. So the two judges, Jewish judges, plot against her and essentially are forcing her with this threat to lie with them. Susanna sighed deeply and said, "I am hemmed in on every side, for if I do this thing, it is death for me. And if I do not, I shall not escape your hands. I choose not to do it and to fall into your hands rather than to sin in the eyes of the Lord." Then Susanna cried out with a loud voice, and the two elders shouted against her. And of course, people came running immediately and so on, and the two elders carried out their threat. They testified before court that they had caught Susanna with this married woman with a young man, that as they rushed in and saw her with this young man, the young man escaped, so of course they could not find the young man anymore, but they testified in effect that Susanna committed adultery. And she is condemned to death by the court in Babylonia. Susanna cried out with a loud voice, "O eternal God, who dost discern what is secret, who art aware of all things, you know that these men have borne false witness against me, and now I am to die," and so on. But just as she's being taken away to her death, a wise Jewish scholar, a young lad named Daniel, the Daniel of Sefer Daniel, came to the rescue. And he called for the court to convene again. And Daniel said to the two judges, "Separate them far from each other, and I will examine them." He wanted them examined separately rather than in the same courtroom. And when they were separated from each other, he summoned one of them, and he said, "You old relic of wicked days, your sins have now come home. Now, if you really saw her committing adultery, tell me this, under which tree did she commit adultery?" And he answered, "Under a mastic tree." The Greek word means under a cut tree. And to which Daniel then says, "Very well, you have lied against your own head, for the angel of God has received the sentence from God and will immediately cut you into two." A play on words. Then he put him aside and he commanded the other judge to come forth. And Daniel turned to the other judge and he said, "You offspring of Canaan and not of Judah, beauty has deceived your heart and lust has perverted your heart. This is how you have been dealing with the daughters of Israel in the past, and you continue to do so now. Now tell me, under which tree did you see Susanna committing adultery?" And he answered, "Under the evergreen oak tree," a different tree. And the Greek term for evergreen oak here is a term which is a yew tree, H-E-W. And he answered, and Daniel said, "Very well, you have lied too against your own head, and the angel of God is waiting for his sword to saw you in two, to you in two, in other words, and may he destroy you both." And it goes on to say, then all the assembly shouted loudly and blessed God who saves those who hope in him. And they rose against the two elders, for out of their own mouths Daniel had convicted them of bearing false witness. And they did to them as they had wickedly planned to do to their neighbor, acting in accordance with the law of Moses. V'asisa lo kasher zamam. They put them to death, and thus innocent blood was saved that day. That essentially is the story of Susanna. To the best of my knowledge, the first Jewish authority to raise the issue of why the Book of Susanna is not included in Tanakh was a great Gaon in Galicia, the Maratz Chayos, Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Chayos, in his Kol Sifrei Maratz Chayot, Kol Sifrei Maratz Chayot, Volume 1, page 94. And I'm holding the text in front of me. Yes. No, we only have Greek versions, unfortunately, of Shoshana. Susanna has not been discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls, or the only version we have is Greek. That raises the interesting question whether or not, and we'll come to it, it was originally written in Greek, or whether it was originally written in Hebrew. Modern scholarly consensus is that it was originally written in Hebrew, that it was a Hebrew book translated into Greek, but we have no Hebrew versions of this book. Maratz Chayos says as follows, and I'll read it in Ashkenazic Hebrew because that's how he wrote it. Gam hamesupa b'sforim halolum in maase shoshana bashilkiyo sherotzu lodunoso b'misa shehidu ba edim shezinsa. He may be rishon kaimelon b'sanhedrin d'bizman sheyesh kohen yesh mishpat. We have a general halacha in the Talmud, and that is that you can only have capital punishment when there is a Kohen Gadol in the Beit HaMikdash. And this whole story as presented takes place in Bavel, in the time of Daniel. There was no Kohen Gadol in the Beit HaMikdash. There was no Beit HaMikdash. And therefore there could not have been capital punishment. So Maratz Chayos says on those grounds alone, the rabbis could not have included this book in the biblical canon. That I refer you to Bavli Sanhedrin 52b, and you'll see the whole discussion there. It moves beyond what we can do here. But there the Talmud says, when there's no Kohen Gadol, there's no capital punishment. It may well. That's right. That's essentially what Maratz Chayos is basically claiming. Let me just finish the passage, then I'll take some more questions. Okay. Va'afim nomar the Daniel hamuskar enenu Daniel ish chamudos. You might claim that the Daniel in the Book of Susanna is not to be identified with, and that would be a simple answer. Then maybe this is a different Daniel who lived in Bayez Sheni times when there was a Kohen Gadol. Even if you claim it's a different Daniel, Achein hamesupar shom besof ki Daniel chokar es edes nus v'huchshu zeba zeb chakiro zeomar shenivlo tachas aloh v'zeomar shenivlo tachas alon v'nemar shom ki osu la'edim kamishpat ha-torah d'chsiv v'asisem lo kasher zamam hinei ze lehefech mikabalosenu d'rak heichidu huzmu ha'edim v'hamase yecholu lios emes m'kaimim din hazoma avol b'chishu ha'achronim es ha'rishonim Ein la eidem mishpat mavis. Maratz Chayos is very clever here. Maratz Chayos knows halacha very well. And Maratz Chayos says, the law in the biblical law in Deuteronomy 19 that talks about false testimony, where a pair of witnesses becomes apparent that they are false witnesses, the Talmud says that this can only occur when a second group of witnesses comes and says, Imanu hayisa. Those two witnesses were with us and could not have been present when the crime was committed. But if you examine the testimony of witnesses, and one witness says it happened under tree X, and the other witness says it happened under tree Y, there's a famous Mishnah, Masechet Makot. This is known as conflicting testimony. Conflicting testimony is not the same as Edim Zomer. When two witnesses disagree in details and their testimony is in conflict, the halacha is we dismiss both witnesses. They both go home and we forget about the testimony. The entire testimony is now is simply dismissed. But we don't put them to death. You put false witnesses to death only when second pair of witnesses comes and says, Imanu Yisim, this is certainly absolutely true according to halakha. And here the Maratz Chayos comes up with what seems to be absolutely infallible evidence that this book flies in the face of certain biblical and rabbinic teaching, and as such could not have been considered as a candidate for the biblical canon, and that's why it was rejected. So Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Chayos, who lived in the first half of the 19th century in Galicia, chief rabbi of Zolkiv, among other places. Solomon Seitlin, a great scholar who lived many years in Philadelphia and taught at what was then known as Dropsy College, wrote a monograph on the biblical canon. Just happened to have a copy with me. And here's what Seitlin writes. This is early 20th century. Daniel, in cross-examining the witnesses, asked the name of the tree under which the act of adultery was committed. In giving different trees, Susanna was not only acquitted, but the witnesses were put to death. This is the biblical law. Then you shall do unto him as he had thought to have done unto his brother. It's Deuteronomy 19:19. The early Tanaim maintained that false witnesses can be put to death only in the case of an alibi, that is, if other witnesses come to testify that the said witnesses were together with them in a different place at the time when the supposed crime took place. If, however, their testimony does not agree, as in the case of the trial of Susanna, the defendant cannot be convicted, and the witnesses are free from punishment. This law was already in existence in the time of Shimon ben Shattach. The author of the book tells us that when Daniel found that the two witnesses were not in agreement about the tree, they were put to death. This clearly shows that the book was written before the time of Shimon ben Shattach. Now, here Solomon Seitlin is a modern scholar, a historian. He has to make sense out of all these conflicting passages, so he says that the rabbinic interpretation can only be dated as early as Shimon ben Shattach. And if the book of Susanna gives a different interpretation, then it's anti-halacha and therefore pre-halacha. It's earlier than the rabbinic halacha. Now I continue with the exact words of Solomon Seitlin. The reason why the book Susanna was not included among the scriptures can be readily understood. For the halacha recorded in Susanna is early halacha and did not agree with the halacha which existed in the year 65, that is 65 of the Common Era. Solomon Seitlin believes that the biblical canon was closed and canonized as we have it in the year 65. That is, the writings, the Ketuvim, were canonized in the year 65. This was sufficient reason for excluding this book from the scriptures, just as the book of Tobit was excluded. Okay. So, essentially, he's taken the Maratz Chayas. Doesn't mention Maratz Chayas' name, but without doubt, he knew the Maratz Chayas by heart and incorporated it and gave it a certain spin to fit in with his historical interpretation. One of the standard reference works that's used to this day in all colleges is called the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. I'm holding one volume from that dictionary in my hands. In the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, under the entry Susanna, we read, one short paragraph is all that I'll read here. The story of the trial indicates the value of cross-examination of witnesses. As narrated, the story is in direct contradiction to the Pharisaic practice, Pharisaic meaning rabbinic, and law that false witnesses can be put to death only on the basis of an alibi, that is, other witnesses show that the first pair of witnesses were with them at the time of the committal of the crime. They were not at the scene of the crime and therefore have given false testimony. Thus, the book of Susanna depicts only a contradiction of witness in fact and not in matter of time. Because of this contradiction to Pharisaic accepted law, the book was not included in the biblical canon. So the Maratz Chayas and what's repeated by Seitlin is now canonized in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. And I could bring many more witnesses, but one more will suffice. I have the Anchor Bible with me. The Anchor Bible is a major modern publication of the Bible with the results of modern Bible scholarship on every biblical book. It has the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the books of the Apocrypha. So I'm holding the books of the Apocrypha known as Daniel, Esther, and Jeremiah, the editions. That is, in the Apocrypha there are editions to Sefer Daniel, Sefer Gilat Esther, and Sefer Yirmiyahu. And all those editions, which are in the Apocrypha, are gathered together in this volume of the Anchor Bible, with an introduction and commentary by Carrie Moore. And so this includes, of course, Susanna. Susanna is one of the apocryphal editions to the book of Daniel. In Greek texts of Daniel, in the Greek version of Daniel, in the Septuagint, the book of Susanna is incorporated in Sefer Daniel. It's part of Sefer Daniel. Canonicity of Susanna. He's wondering why isn't Susanna in the book. More persuasive is the view of Solomon Zeitlin and S.B. Honig that Susanna was finally rejected by the Jewish fathers because in its present form the story clearly contradicts a Pharisee halakha in the Mishnah. And he goes on to say everything that we've said so far, so I won't repeat it again. This is essentially what we know from modern scholarship. Now, there's no question that this is all very sound. Maratz Chayes is right on the money. But we have to ask ourselves whether this was really in the mindset of Chazal. Is this the reason why Chazal rejected, or the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, whoever made the decision, is this the reason why the book of Susanna was rejected by the early authorities? And I now want to take the time to engage together with you in an investigation which will raise some questions about everything that's been said till now. Some interesting questions. So would you look at passage 2, which you have in front of you? And those of you who can follow in the Biblical Hebrew, fine, and below it you have the passage translated into English. There's really nothing to add here. These are a series of verses in Yirmiyahu Perek Chavtet. Beyond what these verses say, we know nothing. That is, what the verses say is that there were two false prophets by the name of Achav ben Koloya and Tzidkiyahu ben Maaseya. And other than what it says here about them, we know nothing about them. That is, they appear nowhere else in Tanakh. We have no extra biblical evidence about these two people. It's a total mystery. And in fact, if you look in the Mefarshim on Tanakh, you'll find nothing about them. If you open up Sefer Yirmiyahu and study with Radak or whoever you want, Mitsudos and so on, not a word is said. We know nothing about these two people. These are the only mentions of these two people in all of Tanakh. But it does say something about them in these verses, as you can see, especially in verse 23, Yan asher asu nevalabi Yisrael. So these two false prophets committed adultery, and aside from committing adultery, they spoke false prophecy. That is, they spoke in the name of God, whatever it is that they spoke in the name of God. Matters asher lo tzivitim, and they die, as you can see in verse 22, a horrible death. They are burnt to death. More about that. We know nothing else about these two people. This is it, what you have in front of you. Chazal, page 2, passage 3, know a lot more about these two prophets. A lot more. And again, those of you who can follow in the Aramaic, it's in brackets for you, the Talmudic passage in Sanhedrin 93a. And I even put in a little pisuk to make it a little easier. Those of you who want to read an English translation, you have the complete passage in Chazal before you, which gives much more information. This fills in the gaps of the biblical passage. And it turns out there's a relationship between the different parts of the verse. That is, these are false prophets who commit adultery. Their adultery is bound up with their false prophecy. And that's, of course, the beautiful exegesis of Chazal, as we have it described here in great detail. So these two prophets gang up, as it were. In this passage in Chazal, it's against Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. We have other parallel passage in Medrash Rabbah and Tanchuma and so on, where it's Nebuchadnezzar's wife, and still other variant readings. We have all sorts of different accounts of this story, but the major themes are more or less as described here in Sanhedrin 93a. For those of you interested, and you should be interested in seeing all the parallel passages, you'll find them in references to them in Louis Ginsberg's Legends of the Jews, in the complete full set, in the notes. You can examine the notes on, examine the index on these two prophets, on Achav and Tzidkiyah, and you'll find everything you need to know in terms of other passages in Chazal about it. This passage in Chazal sounds a lot like Susanna. It's not very different than the story of Susanna. The major themes are all here. But Susanna's name doesn't occur here. In fact, here the victim is, as you can see, Nebuchadnezzar's daughter. Now, what's amazing is, if you examine early literature, like Philo, Josephus, or church fathers, and we're going to be looking at church fathers now, contemporaries of the Tanaim and the Amoraim, in some cases predecessors of the Tanaim and Amoraim, they also preserve biblical traditions. Not only Chazal preserved biblical traditions, but Origen, Tertullian. I couldn't make sense out of this biblical verse. And you have to remember, Jerome had to translate the verse from the Greek into Latin, and or from the Hebrew into Latin, as he read Hebrew as well, and he had the Hebrew in front of him. And Jerome lived where? Where did Jerome live? No, in Bethlehem, right? Beit Lechem Yehuda. He lived in the heart of Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Amoraim. He was surrounded by Amoraim, and Jerome tells us, on occasion, that when he came to a difficult verse, so what do? If you have a difficult verse, where do you turn to? You go to an expert. You ask your local rabbi. So Jerome writes in his commentaries, and he wrote extensive commentaries on all of Tanakh. And in his commentaries, he writes, when I got to this verse, I had no idea what the verse meant. And I went to the local rabbi, and I asked him, tell me, what do your rabbis say? His local rabbi is an Amora. And he records all sorts of such interpretations. Some of them we have in the Gemara, exactly as he records them, exactly as he heard them. And others we don't have in the Talmud. We only have Jerome's recording of what he heard from the rabbis.
Jerome was not an early Jew, was he?
Jerome was a Christian. Was a, he'd be very angry at you if you suggested that he was a Jew. Yeah, no, he was. No. Jerome was a Christian. Yeah, the author of the Vulgate. When he got to Yirmiyahu, in his commentary on Yirmiyahu, Perek Chaf Tet, when he got to this passage, he wondered like anybody would have wondered, who on earth are these two people? And how come we don't hear a word about their false prophecies? Exactly as Chazal explained in Sanhedrin 93a. And here's what Jerome said. This is very interesting. The Hebrews say that these are the elders who wrought folly in Israel and committed adultery with the wives of their fellow citizens. What's different already? Fellow citizens, right? We have to medakdek on every word here. So he heard from the Jews that it wasn't the Nebuchadnezzar's daughter or wife and these different. But he, and by the way, we have Hebrew accounts also that it was Jews. So he has the account that it was the wives of their fellow citizens, and to one of whom Daniel said, "O you who are grown old in evil days," that's in Susanna. So he heard from the Jews that yes, they know about this story. They know about these two prophets mentioned in the book of Jeremiah, and these are the prophets. These are the two Shoftim mentioned in the book of Susanna. And the other of whom he said, "You seed of Canaan and not of Judah, beauty has deceived you, and lust has perverted your heart. Thus you did to the daughters of Israel, and they in fear spoke with you, but a daughter of Judah did not abide your iniquity," meaning Susanna. This is all a quote from Susanna. "And that which the prophet now says, and they have spoken a word in my name falsely, which I did not command them," this is Jeremiah 29:23. "The Jews think that this is indicated by the fact that Ahab and Zedekiah thus deceived wretched women, who are carried about by every wind of doctrine, by saying to them, because they were of the tribe of Judah, the Messiah must be born of their seed, who having been enticed by desire, furnished their bodies as if they were future mothers of the Messiah." It's very interesting. What he heard from Jews was that these two prophets came and turned to Susanna or to other women and would entice those women to engage in sexual relations with them because they told them, you have been selected for the honor of being the mother of the Mashiach. And we, of course, will be the father of the Mashiach. Excuse me? The same. He uses the term Hebraio or Yudaio. It's the same. But that which is said at present, whom the king of Babylon roasted in fire, this is Jerome talking now, but that which is said at present, whom the king of Babylon roasted in fire, take a look, Jeremiah 29:22, seems to contradict the history of Daniel, meaning Susanna. For he asserts that they were stoned by the people according to the option of Daniel. In the book of Susanna, it says they did to them as they wanted to do, and they were stoned to death. But what does it say in Yirmiyahu about these two false prophets? Asher kolam, well, you have the verse in front of you? Beish. When's this fable, we'll talk about it in a minute, when's this fable, the book of Susanna, as it were, is not accepted by very many. So Jerome says there are many who don't accept this book, including almost all the Hebrews. Including almost all the Hebrews. Most Jews don't accept the book of Susanna. Nor is it read in their synagogues. For they say, and now he's quoting the Jews in the quote, for they say, now, what would you think the Jews said? In light of everything we said, what should the Jews have said? Why don't they quote this book? Why don't they read this book? Why do they reject this book? Because this is not Adam Zoman. This is not Imanu. Is no Imanu Yisam here? What are we talking about here? That's not what Jerome says. He asked the Jews, and the Jews said, for they say, how could it be that captives had the power of stoning their leaders and prophets? The Jews were captive in this period. This is during the time of the Nebuchadnezzar. You think that in Bavel the Jews had the right capital punishment? Unheard of. And more than this, they affirm to be true that which Jeremiah writes, that the elders indeed were refuted by Daniel, but that sentence was brought against them by the king of Babylon. It says in Yirmiyahu, it says very clearly, who put them to death? And how were they put to death? They were burnt to death. And who put them to death? That's right, the Melech Bavel, who had the power against the captives as victor and lord. He was able to implement capital punishment. Therefore, Sefer Shoshana, the book of Susanna, cannot be part of the biblical canon. This is the testimony given Jerome, what he heard from Jews. Here he doesn't say rabbi, sometimes he does, but what he heard from the Hebrews, and that usually means the rabbis, as to why this book was not included in the biblical canon. Now, No. They're not going to worry about such niceties, right? He doesn't talk about that. It happens to be a beautiful book. I mean, you'll read it, you'll see. It's hard, you can't put it down once you start reading it. But in any event, what I want to focus on what should be a concern here. What interests me here is that even though Marat Chayes is eminently logical, everything he said is absolutely true, and it was repeated then by every scholar who ever wrote and got into all the biblical handbooks through 1997, when you examine the evidence, it turns out that there were other concerns that concerned the Jews in antiquity, very important concerns, by the way, and those were the primary concerns, apparently, at least as recorded in the early literature, as to why this book was not included in Tanakh. What I really want to get at is the following. Absolutely, no question about it, but what I want to get at is this. Discrepancies between the plain sense of Tanakh and Chazal are everywhere. Those were not grounds for not including a book in the biblical canon. There are two different versions of the Ten Commandments in the Torah. Chazal didn't lose too much sleep over that. They knew exactly how to handle that. There was no reason for excluding something from the Bible. Deuteronomy 24:16, the plain sense of the text, proscribes vicarious punishment. Children cannot be put to death for the fathers. Fathers cannot be put to death for the children. Exodus 34:7 and many other biblical verses, in fact, presuppose that children can be put to death for the fathers. Looks like a contradiction, but Baruch Hashem, Chazal had wonderful ways of resolving these apparent contradictions. Numbers 18:18, when you get a chance sometime, take a look at it. The plain sense of Numbers 18:18 seems to contradict Deuteronomy 15:20. We're now talking here about the Matnot Kuhuna. There's a flat-out contradiction between a passage in Sefer Bamidbar and a passage in Sefer Dvarim, which troubled Chazal and troubled all the medieval commentators, and Ad Hayom Hazeh, they're still trying to solve it. No one decided that a verse should be left out of Tanakh because it looks like a contradiction. Well, to raise Abarbanel's famous question, Deuteronomy 17:15 either requires or at the very least tolerates the appointment of a monarch. In the plain sense of 1 Samuel 8:5 is that apparently no such verse was known in Samuel's day. That is, you would assume that the Jews would have pulled out of their back pockets a little Tanakh and said to Shmuel, but it says, what are you talking about? No one says that in response to Shmuel. Anyway, the list could go on and on. My point is, whether you assume that Tanakh was canonized in one fell swoop, whether you assume it was in stages, as most of modern scholarship, the authorities who canonized Tanakh surely were not troubled by apparent or even real inconsistencies, at least with regard to granting a book biblical status. If everything else was in favor of the book, it was not going to be rejected because of some minor inconsistency. There's a wonderful Yiddish proverb that sums this up well. Funakasha starpminisht. One doesn't die from a question. What were the factors then? What were the factors, and the hour is late, so I want to come to a conclusion. What were the factors then that led either Anshei Knesset HaGdolah or Chazal, as the case may be, to reject the books of the Apocrypha and other candidates for being accepted into the biblical canon? I think the key issues are the following. One, books known to have been authored after the cessation of prophecy. Books known to have been authored after the cessation of prophecy could not be included in the biblical canon. The sine qua non for inclusion of a book in the biblical canon was that it be written Beruach HaKodesh, it had to be written B'Nevuah. If Chazal knew that a book was authored after prophecy ceased, no matter how wonderful the book was, it could not be included in the biblical canon. A prime sample here really is the book of Ben Sira. Ben Sira can be dated. We know when he lived. He lived around 200 B.C. Chazal told us that Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are the last of the prophets. There is no prophecy after Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. That being the case, Ben Sira lived after Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Shakespeare lived after Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and there's no way it could be part of the biblical canon. Anyone who lived after the cessation of prophecy, no matter how wonderful the book, it's not going to get into the biblical canon. And that explains how many of the books of the, what's known as the Apocrypha, Pseudepigrapha, and some of the books of the Qumran literature could not be candidates at all, because, in fact, they were authored after prophecy ceased. Two, books originally composed in Greek or any language other than Hebrew were automatically disqualified from inclusion in the biblical canon. And we know that several books of the Apocrypha and many in the Pseudepigrapha, in fact, were originally written in Greek. Some of the books of Maccabees, the originals, are in Greek, and so on. Anything written in Greek automatically could not be in Tanakh. Any book in Tanakh has to be written in Hebrew, or if in Aramaic, as say for Daniel, as you know, it always includes portions written in Hebrew. This has to do with the Kedusha of the Sefer itself. A book not written in Hebrew or its first cousin Aramaic is not going to be in Tanakh. Three, supposing a book is written in Hebrew, supposing we don't know when it was actually written. Maybe the author lived before the cessation of prophecy. Chazal had no way of knowing, let's say, the one way or the other. There's nothing in the book itself that gives away when it was written. Some of those books were not included in Tanakh in any event, because those books challenged central teachings of Tanakh as we have it, or central teachings of Chazal. There's a book can have a discrepancy, and Chazal could live with discrepancies, but if a book in its very basic teachings presents teachings that are diametrically opposed to either Halacha, to Torah, or to Chazal, then such a book could not be included in the biblical canon. I have in mind, for example, when I say this, the Book of Jubilees. There is a book that's come down to us, not in the original Hebrew, but there's no question it was originally written in Hebrew, Sefer HaYovlim. There are citations of the Hebrew text in the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is a very ancient book. It probably could qualify as belonging to the prophetic period. There was still Nevi'im alive, perhaps, when it was written. There are scholars who claim it was written as early as 600 BCE. But the Book of Jubilees presents a series of teachings that in no way were acceptable to Chazal. So just to give you a simple sample, the Book of Jubilees has a different calendar than our calendar. Every holiday comes out on a different day of the year. When we celebrate Yom Kippur, it's not Yom Kippur for the Book of Jubilees. When it's Yom Kippur for the Book of Jubilees, it's not Yom Kippur for us. Now, if you just bear in mind the simple fact that if a Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodesh Kadoshim on the wrong day of the year, it's a capital crime, you can already see why there's no way the Book of Jubilees could have been accepted by Chazal. Now we're not talking about minor discrepancies. We're talking about every festival as described in the Book of Jubilees being celebrated on the wrong day, as far as Chazal are concerned. Yes. Go ahead. No, in Hebrew. Right. That's right. Well, we have books, for example, that are written in Greek. No, we don't know who wrote them. That's my point. We don't know. But I want to tell you this. The book is in Greek, but the book presents itself as being written by Jeremiah. You see? So here you have a book that even if you were prepared to concede that it was written by a Navi, the book tells you. We have a Greek apocryphon, a pseudepigraph. We have many such ascribed to prophets. We have books ascribed to Ezra, for example. Jeremiah, Ezra, Adam, and Eve even. Well, let's say we don't know whether to accept that or not, but the mere fact that we only have Greek copies will be enough for us to reject it. That's the point. Okay? As I say, in some cases we have doubts. Chazal sometimes had doubts. They had some, and we'll soon come to Ben Sira and we'll see where they had doubts. Fourth category. Some biblical books about which Chazal were uncertain as to whether include in Tanakh or not. That is, there were some opinions in Chazal that it should be included in Tanakh, and some opinions in Chazal that it shouldn't. One of those books that are on the borderline is Ben Sira, and I have to tell you about Ben Sira that there's debate even in modern scholarship as to when he lived. I told you 200 BC, so it's a simple matter that he lived after the cessation of Nevuah. But there are well-established opinions that you could defend the position if you wanted that he lived 300 B.C. And if he lived 300 B.C., you're coming perilously close to the period of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And there were Chazal. There are opinions in Chazal, as I told you. Even a great Gadol like Reb David Hoffman recently was prepared to say that, according to those opinions of Chazal, they were for including Sefer Ben Sira in Tanakh. In any event, it is not part of our Tanakh, yes? Yeah, not Chazal. I want to be very careful here. There was a Ben Sira. His name was Yehoshua Ben Sira, a real person who lived in the either around 300 BCE or 200 BCE. Pick the date that you like. We have his book. We have it in Hebrew. We have it in Greek. It's cited, Psukim from Ben Sira, cited by Chazal, and so on. That's in rabbinic, that's in Talmudic literature, all right? In medieval literature, we have another book called the Alphabet of Ben Sira, not to be confused at all with the book of Ben Sira that we're talking about here. You're citing the Alphabet of Ben Sira, a medieval apocryphal work. In that medieval apocryphal work, it says that Ben Sira was the son of Yirmiyahu, not to be confused with our book. Okay? You're shaking your head as if you follow. Yes, that's right. You won't find that anywhere in Chazal. Okay? Nowhere in Chazal. Now, with regard to such books as Ben Sira, you know why you won't find it in Chazal. Tell me. You just said Ben Sira is Yirmiyahu's son. When did Yirmiyahu live? That's quite a gap. You can't bridge that gap. No way you're going to get the Ben Sira and Yirmiyahu together, even through artificial insemination. They didn't have banks. They didn't have sperm banks then. Okay. All right. With regard to a book like Ben Sira, here's a very interesting phenomenon. Some books, and I'm suggesting this, but it seems to be that one can defend this position, some books which were candidates for inclusion, these borderline books like Ben Sira, were rejected by Chazal, because other groups of Jews, and ultimately Jewish Christians, and then Christians, included them in their biblical canon, in their much larger biblical canons, and Chazal had to draw the line somewhere. That is, the book of Ben Sira, let me put it this way, the Apocrypha is part of the Roman Catholic Bible. Why is the Apocrypha part of the Roman Catholic Bible? Why is it more suited for Catholics than for Jews? There isn't a word about the founder of Christianity anywhere in the Apocrypha. The books of the Apocrypha are our books. They're our books in the post-biblical period, but they've been expropriated by Christianity. Why? That's very simple. Why? What do Christians have in their canon? What's their biblical canon? They have the Old Testament. The Old Testament begins with Adam, the creation of the universe, and continues till the last historical event in the Old Testament. What's the last historical event in the Old Testament? There's nothing in the Old Testament after the Persian period. You won't find a word in anywhere in Tanakh about Alexander the Great. Everything in Tanakh, the last dated event in Tanakh, is the time of Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Ezra, Nehemiah, whatever you like, 5th, 4th century BCE. Last events that are described are the Persian kings, the return under the Persian kings. No historical event described in Tanakh can be identified with certainty as referring to an event from the Greco-Roman period. So it ends about 500 B.C. Modern scholarship will date books late. They can date them as late as they want. But they still have to admit that as late as these books are, they're preserving the traditions through the Persian period. And then what's in the Christian Bible? The New Testament. And what is the New Testament? What period does the New Testament cover? First century. Basically, the description of the founder of Christianity in his period, which is the first half of the first century, and then the apostles, the various Ephesians, the various Pauline letters, and so on and so forth. So all first century, end of the first century. There's a huge gap. On the one hand, you have all these prophetic books through the year 500, and all of a sudden prophecy reappears in the first century. And what about between 500 and the first century? What happened those 500 years? Wonderful. Thank God it is the Apocrypha. So you have the books of the Apocrypha, and the Apocrypha is a link, and in their minds, a prophetic link, a link from the earliest part of the biblical canon to the New Testament, their second part of the biblical canon. Prophecy, they say, never ceased. We have biblical books from all the periods. And we continue right into the New Testament, to which the Jewish response was, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. That's when prophecy ceased. There could be an individual Jew who through Nevuah will make some discovery. God can appear. We have Eliyahu HaNavi. We have all kinds of stories in Chazal. But an apostolic prophet, a prophet with a mission to Bnei Yisrael, doesn't appear after Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Nobody is appointed by God with a message to Klal Yisrael after Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. That's when prophecy ceased. So even though there were books that Chazal looked kindly upon, and in a different set of circumstances might well have included them in Tanakh. But to be sure that no one is confused, and to be sure that no one says, well, if you're going to include that book, we're going to include all the books of the Apocrypha. And if we include all the books of the Apocrypha, we're going to say that prophecy never ceased. And you can even include some books from the first century. Chazal said, no. There are no books after Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. So that, in a nutshell, it seems to me, are probably the best reasons for why certain books were excluded from the biblical canon by either Anshei Knesset HaGdola or Chazal, whoever it was, as the case may be. The hour is late, so I want to conclude, and what I want to tell you is that whatever uncertainties we have about the history of the biblical canon in antiquity, we can speak with some confidence about the biblical canon in the future. That's because the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us, Yerushalmi Megillah, Aleph Zayin, Perek Aleph Halacha Zayin, Rabbi Yochanan Omar, Hanaviim Vaktuvim Atidin Libatel. Very famous passage where Rabbi Yochanan says that the Atid Lavo, in the future, Nevi'im and Ktuvim will be annulled. We will have a different biblical canon in the end of days. Only Torah, no Nevi'im and no Ktuvim. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish disagrees with Rabbi Yochanan. He said, Af Megillat Esther v'halachot enan Atidin Libatel, in which there are different interpretations. One interpretation is, he said, none of the biblical books will be annulled. Even the least, as it were, or the last, if you like, of the biblical books, Megillat Esther, and even all halachot will still obtain. Others say, no, he agreed that Nevi'im and Ktuvim will be annulled, but the only book that will remain together with Torah is Megillat Esther and all halachot, and so on. Anyway, whatever the interpretation may be, we'll stay with Rabbi Yochanan for the 1 minute that I have left. Rabbi Yochanan did say that Atidin Nevi'im uktuvim libatel, so there will be a future biblical canon, a much smaller one. And that being the case, I want to put everyone on notice that if you intend to study Tanakh sometime during your lifetime, if you want to study Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yecheskel, Mishle, Tehillim, and Iov, and so on, you had better do so before the end of days. Thank you very much.